Post-colonial Europe, looking at European identities from a different perspective. A podcast.
My name is Gianna Nestorides, and this is my co-host, Alexandra Tolu.
Hello, Gianna. Hello, everyone.
And today we are discussing racism in the United States of America from a post-colonial perspective. With us, we have Fotini Tolu, a postgraduate researcher on American identities. Fotini, welcome to our podcast.
Hello, and thank you for inviting me. I'm so glad to be part of your project.
Racism has been very topical in the last couple of years.
Right, but before we comment on today's racism, I want to sort of reverse engineer the term racism. Racism is a byproduct of the evolution of the word race. Now, the term race used to refer to a group of people with a shared kinship or connection, but over the course of history, it evolved into this all-encompassing term for people with shared physical and social qualities, and so it became a denominator of class and social standing. The way we perceive the world around us, the way we interact with it from a post-structuralist perspective, is part of the social construction of our reality, and I'm fully aware that I'm echoing Berger and Luckmann's titular book here, but in any case, race, the way we understand it today at least, is a social construct. What is truly mind-blowing and at the same time entirely unsurprising is how so our socially constructed understanding of race is a zero-sum game. It awards benefits and privileges to certain groups of people by denying it to others. In other words, in order for some to win, others must lose.
Sadly, that is so. Difference in color, race, ethnicity, and culture have been interpreted as attributes by which certain groups of people have been labeled as subordinate, while others have been perceived as dominant social groups. In fact, some theories have argued that race is a socially constructed concept, which has been devised by dominant groups in order to establish a certain unequal social hierarchy. For example, Omri and Wynand, in their study Racial Formation in the United States, state that race is a way of making up people.
So how exactly did we come about the present day use of the word race?
Right. So the best way to conceptualize this is perhaps through the use of the word white and its derivative whiteness. You see, the practice of slavery was pretty widespread even in antiquity, although we Greeks tend to overlook it.
I can attest to that. Greek schools merely hint at the class system of the ancient Greek and Hellenistic societies, which I had to learn more about while studying Greek literature and linguistics at the university.
Exactly. Though, to be fair, that version of slavery differs considerably from the chattel slavery we'll see in the US. In ancient Greece, for instance, slavery was not hereditary, and slaves could earn wages and purchase or gain their freedom. But in any case, the point is, whiteness did not initially play a role in the enslavement of people.
How could it? If anything, Greeks were not the whitest folk.
Well, yeah, there's that too. In fact, whiteness became a class characteristic chiefly amongst the high-born ladies in England. To be fair-skinned signified that you needn't trouble yourself with manual labor outdoors.
Why was it particular to ladies?
I can't imagine many men would like to project laziness and a kept sort of profile. Again, playing on the stereotypes and the social constraints of the time. And by the way, we're talking about the Elizabethan era. I should have mentioned this earlier. So from mid to late 16th century. So playing on these stereotypes, men wouldn't want to emphasize their whiteness. But what is perhaps even more interesting is the way racial understanding and racial identities are formed, which is through a process of elimination in a way.
Wait, wait, back up. What do you mean? Eliminating men to focus on women?
Not quite. So I mentioned the term whiteness, but it's interesting that it came to the foreground as a response to colonizing India. You see, by the process of differentiating and excluding the colonized people of India, colored people, the Elizabethan society founded its racially superior identity on whiteness. So the colonized were dark-skinned, but the colonizers were white.
I see what you mean. So how did that initially white social classification of Elizabethan elite women become widespread?
Soon enough, because of this distinction between dark colonized people and white colonizers, whiteness became a factor of privilege. And I guess everyone wants in on something that awards privileges, right? Then again, through the process of colonialism, the settlers brought the concept of whiteness and early racial identity to the colonies. Now, mind you, we're talking about the British colonies of the Americas this time. I should also note that in the next couple of centuries, and primarily during the Age of Reason, it is the European Enlightenment in the 18th century, the feudal and hierarchical systems of yore were challenged and new ideas regarding the natural rights of men became mainstream, with perhaps most ironic being the concept of equality. In the absence of the old hierarchies, a new system should be implemented. This is, I guess, why racism was primarily fueled by, should I call it economic exploitation? In essence, they needed cheap labor. And what is the cheapest kind? The free kind. Hence why the settlers captured and enslaved Americans and indigenous people to use them for enslaved and coerced labor. But I'm sure Fotini has more to say on this. Actually, Fotini and Alexandra, I've been meaning to ask you, and I know we're kind of bypassing a significant part of history here, but I was thinking perhaps you could tell us more about the way racism against indigenous people was prevalent in Northern American society, because I'm mostly focused on African Americans, but that equal focus should be paid to the indigenous people's struggles.
Well, when it comes to Northern America's native peoples, the eliminating process they have undergone by first European colonizers and afterwards founded American and Canadian nation has even raised the issue of colonial genocide. Let me ground on one example of boarding schools, a reality functioning in both USA and Canada. Theodore Fontaine, one of the survivors of a Canadian boarding school, now an activist and author, talks about not only physical and sexual abuse of Indigenous children in boarding schools, but emphasizes on psychological manipulation and loss of identity. In the foreword of the book Colonial Genocide in Indigenous North America by Hinton, Woolford, and Benvenuto, he gives a striking image of the environment and the circumstances they endured. I quote him, It was not much until later, in my intense discomfort with being an Indian, that I understood that the government and its agents, the churches, had in fact been intent on killing me as an Indian person. Their aim was to destroy the indigenous nations by taking away the children, using the tools of racism, indoctrination, removal, and institutionalization. We would no longer exist as indigenous people or as nations. So it is interesting to observe here how this form of institutionalized racism is perceived from today's point of view as overt racism. But has it always been that way? Was killing the Indian in the child not perceived as an obvious form of racism because there was not obvious violence involved? Fontaine seems to think so, adding that the Indian residential schools policy was portrayed as well-intentioned, though misguided, with events in history. So, Joanna, to circle back to you, now that we understand a little better the racism Indigenous people face and continue to face, what parallels do you draw between them and the African-American community?
What parallels? That in both cases, there is a trail of blood and tears to follow. And I must say, I'm willing to follow it because that's the least we can do as white privileged people, you know, study history, pay attention to details, educate ourselves to be proactive allies. But somehow it always feels like it isn't enough, right? I mean, look at the systemic violence that to this day continues to shape public policy and private affairs. It too can be traced back to slavery. And I'm going to have to take us back in time again, I'm afraid. So for instance, anti-blackness and slavery became prevalent in the newly colonized America. And then a series of laws enacted in Virginia, namely the partus sequitur ventrem, the hereditary condition that essentially means that all children born from a slave mother were automatically born into slavery themselves, pretty much increased the number of slaves across the colonies. By that time, you see that slaves, African Americans, indigenous people, were a means to an end. But once the religious pretext was removed, and I'm referring to the removal of the religious clause that prohibited slave owners from keeping slaves in bondage once they converted to Christianity, it became solely about race. So you've got all these grandiose ideas of liberty, equality, individualism, self-government, the, essentially the cornerstone of American identity to this day, a true revolutionary thinking, which produced eventually the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights in the American Constitution, then again, the American Constitution itself, so groundbreaking to say that we, the people, that was earth-shattering for that particular moment in history. And then you've got the Three-Fifths Compromise between the Northern and the Southern states, which essentially meant that an enslaved person only counted for three-fifths of a free person, which gave disproportionate representation and power to slave owner states, and eventually, as we've seen, led to the Civil War.
Yes, not that the Civil War was indeed about the abolition of slavery,
Well, yeah, of course. I feel like it would take me at least a couple hours to fully illustrate my point. So I'll just say this. Yes, the abolition of slavery promoted by the Northern states played indeed a significant role in this, and that led to the secession of the Southern states, which formed the Confederacy. But the argument for the abolition wasn't built solely on morality, Puritanism, ethos, and idealism. There was a question of economic and commercial survival, or to put it differently, the economics of slavery. The northern states were industrialized, whereas the southern states drew their wealth from agriculture. But I want to focus elsewhere because for the many reasons that it occurred, the American Civil War did in fact occur, and abolitionists won, and then the Reconstruction era came. But although slavery was eventually abolished, Black people were constantly discriminated against. Their suffrage, the right to vote, essentially. And by there, I'm not referring only to Black people here, as Indigenous people ultimately and unfortunately suffered a similar fate. So their right to vote, although constitutionally enshrined, was constantly abridged by state legislatures. And then you've got all these Jim Crow laws and the segregation, the KKK. All this is pretty much overt racism. This is institutionalized racism at its finest. And then the one constant in all of this is, again, how on earth a country that prides itself for being the cradle of modern democracy, of liberalism, the first country that codified in its constitution certain unalienable rights, to this day continues to marginalize, discriminate, oppress, and unfortunately even kill ethnic groups on the basis of racial differentiation. So why? Why is race still a zero-sum game?
Yes, I understand your problem here. Speaking of modern-day racism, somehow it is sinister still that today racism isn't overt, as you mentioned before. It manifests in many covert ways, like this issue that was reported by Twitter users who reported the platform's systematic crop out of figures of Black people in uploaded pictures, one algorithm that in a way makes Black figures disappear. Twitter literally goes colorblind in Black people, turning the existing difference into non-existent. So could we draw from this example to assume this is the case with covert racism, although seemingly absent, deliberately muted, it deeply remains segregating? I think these are questions we need to elaborate on, routing them to North America's case. So, Vodini, if you could discern some wider categories on which to talk about covert racism, which would this be?
Well, you mentioned colorblindness, and that is definitely an appropriate term for it. Actually, counter-hegemonic arguments have come to the foreground in order to resist the discourse of racism, especially during the 1960s and the civil rights movement that emerged in the US. During the past few years, more theoretical concepts that seek to counter racism have emerged. But are they indeed liberating, or they do turn out to be new forms of covert racism dominating the academic thought? For example, the concept of colorblindness, pertinent to your statement about the Twitter mechanism of effacing Black figures. Colorblindness can briefly be described as a racial ideology which holds that the best way to end discrimination is to treat individuals as equally as possible with regard to race, ethnicity, or culture. Colorblindness views race as a pernicious concept. Yes, yet, this discourse renders race a taboo issue that is not openly discussed. Ethnic minorities and underrepresented ethnic groups in the U.S. argue that race continues to negatively affect their lives and strip them of equal opportunities. On the contrary, white American people recurs to colorblindness because usually they do not understand how race affects minorities or other ethnic identities. Along these lines, opponents of colorblindness argue that this discourse creates a society that does not acknowledge negative racial experiences, rejects cultural heritage of specific ethnic groups, and invalidates their unique perspective. Overall, it erases difference. By the way, besides colorblindness, theoretical scholars have divided overt racism into a second category, multiculturalism.
I keep forgetting that even multiculturalism has negative connotations. So, correct me if I'm wrong in this, but essentially, multiculturalism carries within it the same privilege that cosmopolitanism does, like the pretext that one is wealthy and privileged enough to travel and engage with the other cultures, or is it something different?
Actually, yeah, the positive aspect of multiculturalism is definitely pluralism, in the sense that multiple different identities coexist within the same nation state. Yet, its not so positive aspect is that it constructs a notion of integrated and assimilated identity for the different ethnic and cultural groups that cohabit the same national state. So, in a way, it faces the cultural specificity and uniqueness of different ethnic groups.
So now we change the background. Thank you for me for those information. That was very helpful to clarify the issue of covert racism. Now I want to address another question to you. Do you think that in the Mexican-American world and the Southwest, we can refer to the construction of the railroad as a form of racism that, though transparent today, at that time it was considered a subtle way to read native peoples? Meaning that it worked as a way not only to displace Mexican Americans, but also to state the arrival of a new dominant culture?
When discussing the position of Mexican Americans in the US, we need to bear in mind that they came to existence as an ethnic group after the annexation of Mexico's northern provinces by North America in 1848. This historical event, most often discussed by scholars as an instance of eternal colonialism, formed the ground for the subsequent racial, socio-political, economic, and cultural subjugation of Mexican Americans by multifarious U.S. mechanisms. In fact, the construction of railroads throughout the Southwest that started during this period has been foregrounded as an intervention that would promote modernization, industrialization of the Southwestern states, as it would foster commercial transaction, it would render the movement of populations much more easier. Yet, the arrival of the railroad was a mechanism through which a large number of Anglo-American populations reached the southwestern areas in search of new economic opportunities and social advancement. The rich national resources of these frontier states, such as mines in the states of California and Arizona, attracted many Anglo-Americans to the area. These Anglo-American newcomers usurped Mexican-American lands by manipulating institutional and juridical and political mechanisms to their benefit. Even in the states where Anglo-Americans were a minority, they formed alliances with Mexican-American ricos, that is, rich people, gained socio-political power and economic power, and established a new, highly racist political order. For instance, the construction of the Santa Fe Railroad, which was initially designed to serve the state of New Mexico, actually resulted in the formation of a Santa Fe Ring, that is, a political group consisting mainly of Anglo-Americans who shamelessly manipulated the legal system and forced the territorial legislature to pass laws that dispossessed the Mexican-American farmers of their lands in order to promote the ring's interests. That is the information historian Rudolfo Acuña offered. Thus, in the years between the mid-19th and the mid-20th century, a large number of Mexican-Americans suffered the loss of their land due to the new socio-political circumstances that the arrival of the Anglo-American newcomers created. The loss of lands also resulted in the socio-economic subjugation of Mexican-Americans who were designated as second-class citizens, as culturally subordinate. Economic predicament eroded the traditional lifestyle of Mexican-American farmers, who were now turned into landless wage laborers. In fact, a large number of Mexican-origin populations were employed as construction workers for railroad lines throughout the Southwest by mid-20th century, and were usually paid lower wages than Anglo-American workers, being further subjugated by the U.S. capitalist and overtly racist system.
Well, see, these are some information. So we could suggest that the construction of the railroad has been perceived as a covert form of racism at the time it took place, yet we can refer to it as an overt form of racism nowadays. Moving on to today, can we discern some direct and indirect forms of racism in the US? What about Donald Trump's practice of re-establishing a fence border between Mexico and the US? Can Trump's practice be viewed as an overt manifestation of racism, since it tried to keep Mexican populations away from the US? And along these lines, do you think that today our reflexes are more ready to consider this borderline as an act of overt racism?
Well, the United States have always treated the U.S.-Mexico border in ways that promoted their interests. For example, in the past, they have militarized the border in order to deter the crossing of Mexican origin populations to the U.S., especially through the enforcement of the Border Patrol that began in the 1920s and 30s. Yet, whenever the U.S. was in need of cheap labor pools, it used to open the border for Mexicans to enter and do the back-breaking work that would sustain the U.S. economic interest. During the presidency of Trump, he firmly barricaded the U.S.-Mexico border as he built a huge border wall separating the two countries and forbidding the entrance of Mexican populace to the U.S. This fixed boundary and Trump's denial to include any more Mexican people in the U.S. nation is evidence of his overall nationalistic discourse and politics that indirectly and forcefully exclude racially and ethnically different people from the U.S. society. At least this is what certain scholars suggest. Of course, given that Mexican Americans living in the U.S., nowadays they are not a minority, but an ethnic group that has managed to represent itself in sociopolitical as well as cultural and academic spaces. So Donald Trump has perhaps interpreted the arrival of more Mexican origin populations in the U.S. as a threat to his nationalistic discourse, which proclaims national purity. Overall, discussions over the issue of racism are growing in various fields of study and in all social realms worldwide. Thus, such mechanisms are quickly met with judgment, criticism, and counter-argument.
Yes, I totally agree. And maybe we could add to that Trump's controversial suggestion to pad the wall with solar panels in an ultimate effort to coat his explicit act of racism with a silver lining, an effort to convert an overt act of racism into a covert. But as you said, discussions of racism have been generalized and have gone a long way towards improving the situation.
Well, this has been really fascinating. It has been truly helpful towards understanding racism in North America and will help us actually to meet our conclusion.
Yes, Ioana, I have to agree. All the answers have been really enlightening and I think have helped me to strengthen my belief that racism, let alone its distinction into overt and covert forms, is actually a cultural term. And by that, I mean a term which is perceived in a different way depending on the historic period and the constantly converted cultural conditions. What do you think, Ioana?
So one thing is that it's been a year of reckoning, for sure. I mean, the Black Lives Matter movement gained momentum because of, unfortunately, ongoing police brutality. The Confederacy flag was recently carried by the mob that broke into the Capitol and interrupted the joint sessions. And the ongoing pandemic has affected disproportionately the minorities, which brought racial equality to the foreground once again. So all in all, the winds are changing. And this gives us the chance to actually continue this dialogue.
Yes, for instance, nowadays, the expanded discussion on racism has made clearer the distinction between its overt and covert forms, and has even made us more capable of detecting them. So it seems like we have evolved towards a bigger inclusivity and acceptance of difference. So we have to continue to stay alert. As we departed further from our colonial past, let's be critically mindful of its legacy and make this a change for the best.
And at this point, we'd like to thank again both our audience and our guest speaker for being here.
Thank you so much for letting me be part of this.
Thank you too, Potini. We hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we did. Bye.